This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Like it or not, you know the slogan.
You have some more.
Once you pop, you can stop. Once you pop, hey, yeah, you can stop.
Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Michael Moss confirms it. Once you pop that Pringles can, you really can't stop. In his new book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, he dives into the $1 trillion processed food industry and the science and business behind manufacturing mouth-watering, craveable foods. The book is now out on paperback. Michael Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you use the phrase bliss point throughout the book. What is the bliss point?
So you have to love the language that this processed food industry uses when they think they're just talking to each other about their efforts to maximize the allure of their products. Salt, they call the flavor burst. Fat, the mouthfeel. Bliss point is the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much, that describes their efforts to send us over the moon, their products flying off the shelf. I was actually lucky to spend time with the guy who invented the term.
Wow.
A legend in the industry, Howard Moskowitz.
So the bliss point is not just about satisfying a craving and a taste in itself, but actually manufacturing a craving. Tell us more about that.
Well, or engineering in his term. He is trained in experimental psychology from Harvard, responsible for many of the icons in the grocery store. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, in which it's an engineering process as he describes it. He started with no less than 59 different formulations of sweetness, each one just slightly different than the others, subjected that to 3,000 consumer taste tests around the country, took the data, threw it in his computer, did his high math regression analysis thing, and out comes these charts of bell-shaped curves like kids get graded on at school, except that the top of the curve is not the dreaded middle C, but the bliss point, the perfect amount of sweetness, not too little, not too much.
For the book, you visited Moskowitz and the Monell Chemical Senses Center. So tell us what that is.
Well, Monell is a center that receives funding both from the government and from the food industry, but its researchers are incredibly independent-minded. They are looking at the basic tastes and our growing dependence, in fact, on processed foods. It was Monell where I learned that we're not even born liking salt. That doesn't develop until about 6 months of age. And they did a recent study showing that kids who are exposed to grocery food, which is inherently typically very salty, are much more apt to be licking the salt shaker by the time they're in pre-K than kids who are fed, you know, whole, natural, fresh vegetables and fruits. And so what that tells us is that the industry is not just responding to our genetic liking for salt in this case, but actually causing us, affecting us to develop cravings for us.
I wouldn't imagine the food industry welcoming investigation of how food flavors are engineered to suck people in. How did you gain access to this facility, the Monell Chemical Senses Center, were scientists open to talking to you about their research?
Well, the book is filled with inside documents. I was lucky to come across a trove of them, some 8 million pages that put me at the table of the largest food companies in the country as they're formulating and marketing their products. And it was those documents that enabled me to identify key players in the industry, convince them to talk to me. They opened up and told even more secrets, because one of the surprising things, many of them have come to have substantial regret about their life work. So these are on-the-record interviews of bench chemists and marketing officials and CEOs, basically explaining to me how they did it.
Did they talk with you about calculating this bliss point and this mouthfeel and this flavor burst?
No, absolutely, for product after product that I sort of go through in the book. I mean, look, they will argue that they are they are coming somewhat short of actually encouraging us to overeat, right? Overconsume. And I totally buy into it. I don't see this as this evil industry that intentionally set out to make us overweight or otherwise ill. They are companies doing what companies do, which is to try to make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible and maximizing the allure of their product. But I have to say, looking at the documents and the interviews, the overwhelming sense you get is that this is an industry that's driving day and night to get us not just to like their products, but to want more and more of them. And that's, of course, where the problem lies. It's not salt, sugar, fat. It's the huge amounts in processed foods and our growing reliance on processed foods.
Michael Moss is with us. We're talking with him about the paperback release of his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Why did these scientists and food engineers feel regret, do you think? I mean, they may not have set out to hook people, but have they seen how far it's gone and feel culpable?
I opened the book with this meeting in 1999 of the CEOs of the largest food companies in North America. It's a very private meeting. They rarely get together, but they have been called together. It's the old Pillsbury headquarters in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to discuss none other than the emerging obesity epidemic. And they've been asked to come and talk about it by none other than people within their own companies, cabals of insiders who are becoming increasingly concerned about their culpability in obesity. And up before them stands one of their own, a senior official from Kraft. He's armed with 114 slides, and he lays at their feet not just culpability for obesity, but diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. He even links highly processed foods to several types of cancers, and he pleads with them to collectively start doing something on behalf of consumers to make their products healthier.
Well, so Kraft undertakes this anti-obesity initiative beginning in 2003, a couple of years after that meeting. How has that worked out for them?
Well, here's the problem. And first of all, Kraft does three incredibly amazing things. It decides it's being over-aggressive in marketing its least healthy products to children. It cuts back on that. It decides it's being less than honest with consumers in disclosing calorie loads in snack packages with more than a couple of servings, because their own data showed that many of us will eat the entire package, and if they didn't see the total calorie count, would get not a full sense of how much they're eating. And they also put limits on the amount of salt, sugar, fat that their chemists could add to the products. What happened was that Kraft, because they weren't able to convince the whole industry to join them in this anti-obesity initiative, was acting unilaterally, and they immediately ran into trouble in the cookie aisle, where other companies came in with fatter, richer, bigger cookies, and Kraft felt it had to respond. That's when we started seeing the double stuff Oreo and the triple stuff Oreo and variations on and on and on.
They describe it not only pinpointing the amount of salt and fat and sugar needed to hit this bliss point, not too much, not too little, but also the feeling that those ingredients produce. Like what?
Well, if you ask me, I'm actually more of a salt, fat sort of guy. It's potato chips for me. I mean, look, and in fact, they have all three. Potato chips, if you know, have a good amount of salt. The industry describes that as the flavor burst. They have the fat, right, which is not one of the five basic tastes. It's a feeling that gets picked up by the trigeminal nerve. But just like salt goes right to the reward center of the brain, which sends out those signals of pleasure that encourage us to do more. But something I didn't know is that potato chips are also loaded with sugar in the form of the simple potato starch, which gets converted to glucose the second it hits the tongue.
It's all making sense now.
Right, it does. I got cravings talking to these food scientists and listening to their incredibly skillful efforts to maximize the allure.
And as I hear this, you know, scientists fiddling around to make food more craveable, kids high on sugar, big money going into marketing, sounds very familiar. The tobacco industry comes to mind. Do you see a parallel?
Well, there was a parallel. Philip Morris, the largest tobacco company, became the largest food manufacturer starting in the 80s when it bought General Foods and then Kraft. First couple decades of ownership, you see the tobacco managers through the documents doing what you would expect of them. They're nudging, cajoling their food managers to sell more product, even lending them some of their marketing schemes. But in the late 90s, something really surprising happens. Philip Morris gets religion on government intervention. It becomes the first company to embrace government regulation of tobacco. And when they do that, the tobacco managers turn to their food managers and warn them that they're going to have as great or greater problem with salt, sugar, fat, obesity as Philip Morris was having with nicotine and tobacco. Mm-hmm. And they urge the food managers to start reducing their, lowering their dependence on those three ingredients.
Well, the tobacco industry did come under heavy fire for misleading smokers about the dangers and addictive nature of cigarettes. We all know it's bad. Smoking has dropped dramatically in the past 20 years. Could the same thing happen for processed food?
I think we're at a real tipping point. More and more people are caring about what they're putting into their bodies. They're starting to translate that into purchase decisions. If nothing else, the processed food industry is acutely sensitive to sales drops, and they will respond. They will make truly healthier versions of their products if forced to do it by declining sales.
Michael Moss, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Moss, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, reporter for The New York Times, and author to the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. There's much more on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. From food scientists manipulating flavors to promote cravings to mega-dollar marketing campaigns, the food industry goes to great lengths to raise profits. What if your bottom line was not about dollars, but devotion? Roman Mars of the 99% Invisible podcast brings us this story of a group of Trappist monks who brew the highest-rated beer in the world, all, in their view, for the glory of God.
Cyrus Farivar is on a mission. He's trying to get a case of beer called Westvleteren.
Westvleteren. I'm not Dutch, so I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's Westvleteren.
It's not easy to get, but apparently it's worth it.
Oh, yes.
If you're a beer nerd or have a friend who's a beer nerd, you've probably heard of Belgian beers. Belgians take their beer very seriously. There are about 200 breweries in a country about twice the size of the Bay Area.
Now, amongst these Belgian breweries and Belgian ales, there's a very specific subtype. Trappist beers. Here's what you need to know about Trappist beers. First, they're amazing. Second, they're made by Trappist monks. These monks trace their roots to a monastery in 17th century France and have since spread out to all over the world.
The main concept behind the Trappist lifestyle is that the abbey should be economically self-sufficient. In other words, the monks should make something and sell it to the public as a way to fund the operations of the abbey itself. Some make cheese, some make spirits. There's even one in Germany that makes lentil soup.
But none of the Trappist products are nearly anywhere as famous as the beer.
But here's the thing about Westvleteren. You can't go there and have as much beer as you want. You can't even have it shipped from the abbey.
If you want to buy beer to take with you, you have to look up the beer reservation phone number on the abbey's website. Then you call this certain phone number during certain hours on certain days. If you're lucky enough to talk to a monk, and yes, you do talk to a monk, to take your reservation, you have to give your license plate number and be available to come pick up your crate during the appointed time that weekend. You're limited to one crate per person, per car, maximum two per car. And you can't buy more than one crate during a 60-day period. Oh, and you agree not to resell the beer as well.
For information, please see our website.
You got that. There is a list of several seemingly arbitrary hoops that you have to jump through if you want to buy this beer. This sort of thing is not unheard of. Velvet ropes and random reward have long been imposed to create artificial scarcity and to heighten demand. But the mainstream trend today seems to be more geared towards greater access and accommodation for customers. The new ideal is that everything is available at all times, no matter where you live. This is the digital age, but clearly, This is not the case for the West Vlaeteren Trappists. They're trying to make it as difficult as possible.
No. They don't make it difficult. You make it difficult. too much people want this beer.
This is Jeff Vondenstein. He's the author of a book called Trappist, The Seven Heavenly Beers. And he's even a brewer himself.
Until 10 years ago, you could go to the Abbey, except on Sunday, because then they don't work. And except on Friday, because Friday they don't work, because they don't eat. But Saturday they were open, so you went there, and without problems you could buy beer. Not as much as you want, 3 crates or 2 crates. But then the Americans, it's all your fault.
I'm sorry.
The Americans said West Vlaeteren is the best beer of the world. They decided we brew the same amount as the last 40, 50 years. And they have enough of that. So why must they brew more? Because you won't. No. They live between the walls of the Rebbe, so for them it's not a problem.
Clearly the West Vlaeteren Trappists take pride in creating something great that people enjoy. But you, the consumers of beer, are not the real customer. God is.
The head of the Abbey says on their website, "We are not brewers. We are monks. We brew beer to be able to afford being monks."
And in that sense, their sometimes frustrating customer service is designed perfectly for the customer they care about most. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Sarus Farivar and me, Roman Mars. It's a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco. We're distributed by PRX at prx.org.
After the break, word of mouth continues, considering how we eat, with a look at the sticky business of making maple syrup. From black market sales to stolen syrup, we're going to test the quaint image of New England's sweetest export. Stay with us for that when word of mouth continues.